You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Okay, this week I have Christine, who is the president slash executive director slash, I don't know, czar, whatever term you want. She's executive director of Pro-Life Humanists. How are you doing, Christine?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
And I first saw you as a guest post on Hemant Mehta's blog, The Friendly Atheist. And that was, that's been a while ago. I thought that was more, it's been since March, apparently. I'm looking at the date. Feels like yesterday, but you know, when you're when you put out 5 or 6,000 podcasts a week like I do, I guess time just flies, you know. It's just like
I think that's the case for all of us. It flies.
Yeah, so geez, I was gonna say that was like a couple months ago, but it's clearly more than that. But anyway, I saw you on there. I read your article, and not sure if you know anything about my show, but I really like to try to get, you know, all sides of arguments about atheism stuff, so I thought you would be perfect to have on here.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue that atheists disagree on. Surprisingly enough, not as many atheists as we've been led to believe, because roughly 1 in 5 atheists, or people who are non-religious, identify as being pro-life. And you get that from the Gallup polls that show that 1 in 5, or roughly 19% of the nons, as we're called, do not agree with the status quo on abortion.
Well, you say it's the status quo in Canada, right? That's where you're based out of?
Yes, I am.
It's not exactly the status quo here, I wouldn't think. It's a little more 50-50, I guess, or do you know anything about that?
Regarding the laws, or?
Just the United States, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I was on your blog a bit, and it definitely seems like Canada is way more cool with abortion than the United States is. Just in like, you know, the culture and the, you know, how big of a factor the religious right is here. I mean, it's not, it would be weird to say that it's like the norm here to be totally cool with abortion, I'd say.
Yeah. In Canada, actually, abortion is legal through all 9 months. Now, there are hospitals that will, different hospitals will set up their own standards, but there is no law in Canada. And that's something that's a bit different in the States.
Yeah.
However, with the laws as they were written, the amendment or the allowance for privacy basically is so huge that even where there are restrictions, they're wide enough to essentially allow abortion on demand in many, many places.
And are you talking about Canada or here?
In the States as well. Canada.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm pretty sure that there's no third trimester here, right? I don't know. I haven't had an abortion lately. I'm not sure. But
actually, that is a myth. Even in the States, the abortion is available on demand, even in the third trimester, because the exceptions that are made for the health of the mother, for instance, are so wide that you could basically drive a truck through them. So you have... I mean, there just recently was a documentary called After Taylor where they profiled 4 late-term abortion providers who are performing abortions throughout the fullness of abortion, of gestation. So it is happening. And it's not just happening for, you know, to save the life of the mother. Oftentimes what we're seeing is it's happening for fetal deformities, which include, for instance, Down syndrome.
Technically illegal, but because of allowances for...
Oh, no, it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal. You have even cases where there's sex selection abortions happening. And you can find that documented. There's been plenty of cases throughout the States. You can find that documented as well, where baby girls are being targeted once somebody finds out that they are female just because of their gender.
So you're saying it's entirely a myth that it's not allowed in the third trimester?
That's correct.
I really did not know that. Are you, just out of curiosity, is this your main, how active in atheism in general are you? Is this more your main issue, or are you also, I mean, being in Canada, I guess it's a little different.
Yeah, I'm actually involved in the atheist community quite heavily. I'm a member of my local CFI group, which is the Center for Inquiryism. We also have a local humanist association that I attend many meetings of. There's also the Ottawa Skeptic Society. So I generally tend to kind of float around and go to a lot of those
okay,
meetings.
Cool. Yeah, because I was just curious about, you know, kind of what it's like being pro-life and being an atheist. And I just wasn't sure if how active you are. But it sounds like you're pretty active in the community. So
Yeah. And I go to as many of the conferences as I can, because I find those are quite enjoyable.
So how do you, and you know, there's a lot I want to get to, but I was just, at first, I just was wondering, how do you feel kind of as a pro-life atheist? Do you feel like it's a minority position? Do you feel like there's, you know, hostility? How does it go for you in general?
Yeah, it depends on where I am. Often humanists and people who identify as free thinkers tend to be more open to discussing the differences and, you know, the reasons why somebody might be pro-life versus pro-choice. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that there's also a certain segment of the atheist community, and I'm not going to name any names or organizations, who have a more, let's say, less free-thinking mentality when it comes to this, a little bit more closed-minded. And there's a certain segment of the atheist community that would very much love to shut pro-lifers out of the atheist community entirely. And there's plenty of blog posts that you can find that would share that sentiment.
Right. I'm pretty sure that the guest post you wrote, I remember there was a bit of hubbub about that, of people getting mad at Hemant for even letting you post that.
Yeah. And that actually surprised me, because, you know, if we're going to be really free thinking, and if we're going to be able to question our values and our assumptions and our beliefs, then why should there be any issues that are off limit?
I totally agree with you. And I likely disagree with you on abortion to some extent, but I totally agree that I don't like the hostility. And I think that it's very worthwhile to talk about the arguments, because I think that I, for one, am not very certain on this issue. I'm pretty certain that I want women to have access to abortion, but as far as all the details and all, is it right in every case, is, you know, et cetera, I think there's a lot of gray area. And I think the worst thing you could do with that amount of gray area is shut out one side of the conversation. So I definitely agree with you there. Mm-hmm. So let's try to get into it a little bit. I think there's a lot to cover, so I hope I don't miss any good parts of it. But what would you say are some of the arguments that are the main reasons you are against abortion? And real quick, are you against abortion in any case? Are there certain allowances? Is it okay in certain, danger to the mother's life situations? Or what's your stance overall, if you don't mind?
Sure. Well, my general opposition to abortion comes because I believe in equal rights. And when I look out at humanity, I see that we're all different. We're all different sizes. We're all different levels of intellect. We all have different levels of ability, different genders. And there isn't any one thing that I can see that we all have in common that should justify certain people having rights and certain people not having rights. If we're all going to have equal rights, at least when it comes to the right to live, then I don't see any justifiable reason for excluding the preborn from the definition of human being and human person.
Go ahead. I was going to ask if that means you don't see any acceptable, acceptable time for an abortion or acceptable circumstances.
When it comes to, for instance, the life of the mother, that's a situation where I believe both are human beings. And if the woman is going to die prior to the fetus being old enough to survive outside the womb, well, then there's no point in forcing her to remain pregnant and then to lose both lives. But in the case when she is at a stage when the fetus has a chance of surviving outside the uterus, then I would advocate for let's have an early end to the pregnancy that doesn't just result in the child's death. So, for instance, a C-section, premature labor. Hmm. So, in that regard, it's better to save one life than to lose both lives. One of the reasons why the so-called isms are wrong, so sexism and racism and any time we're discriminating against people, is because we are putting the emphasis on characteristics rather than on the actual being having these characteristics.
Okay.
And that's what makes discriminating against the unborn wrong, because we're looking at the functions rather than the functioner. We're looking at what they can do versus what they are. And when we look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was crafted shortly after the Holocaust, they declared that all members of the human family deserve these rights, one of which in Article 3 is the right to live. And if all members of the human species are to be included, then if the preborn are members of the human species, which biologically they are, then it does not make any sense to deny them personhood based on characteristics that we would not use to deny anyone else personhood.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So when do you think the fetus becomes a member of this great club called humans, where it gets to take part in those benefits? I mean, how do you approach that question?
Right. Well, it's not so much about what I think. It's about what the scientific community has agreed on.
Sure.
The consensus is that living creatures reproduce after their own kind. Dogs produce dogs, cats produce cats. And when two human beings reproduce, that entity that is created when they've reproduced is only going to be of their species.
That sounds so biblical.
Well, no, I mean, that's just the principle of biogenesis, which is not from the Bible. It's a principle of biology. When we begin, our human development begins at fertilization. If you look at, birth is not the beginning of our bodies. Our bodies began to develop much before birth. And when you trace back our development of our bodies, all of us, as our bodies, had bodies that were fetal bodies, bodies that were embryonic bodies, bodies that were zygotic bodies. We have developed from the moment that we came into fertilization. That's when our actual bodies, our entity as male, female, the genetic traits that we have, began.
So under your view, it's the moment of conception, essentially, the moment of, sperm meets egg. Is that, that's when it's a human?
Well, that's when biologically it's human. I think sometimes we get a little bit confused, and I saw this happening in some of the blog posts and people that responded to me, because sometimes people think when I say human, they think automatically I'm equating it to person. Now, I do believe that all human beings biologically should be persons. In fact, like I said, that's what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights declares. But I don't believe that it's an automatic that science declares the rights. Science, biology, just tells us what species an entity belongs to. It doesn't tell us why we should value that entity. Now, because they are biologically of our species, I have to then ask, on what grounds would I not grant them human rights? And all the reasons that I've found that people will give to deny the preborn human rights come down to reasons that would also disqualify other human beings from having rights. For instance, consciousness. Well, not all born human beings are currently conscious. There are some of them that are in reversible comas, for instance. There are some of them that are under anesthesia. We don't all have that equal amount of consciousness at all stages of our human lives. And yet, at all stages of our human lives, we have one thing in common, and that's our basic humanity, which we have from fertilization.
Hmm. Can I ask, are you a vegetarian then? Do you see any animals as having these same rights, or is it strictly, it sounds sort of speciesist right now?
Well, I am a vegetarian, and many of the members of my group are as well. In fact, I've got a number of vegans who are in my organization. However, I don't think that's a necessity to being pro-life.
I don't think it's a necessity of being pro-life, but as the way you lined up the arguments, it sort of could go there. But sorry, go on.
Yeah. I do think that there is an argument to be made for animal rights. I think that definitely when we consider how much they suffer, I think that should be taken in consideration. There are certainly a lot of animals that are very, very cognitive and have a lot of personhood traits, if you want to say, like, you know, they will socialize and they will care for their young and they seem to demonstrate moral awareness. And I think, you know, that's fine. Let's talk about including them into the family of person. Mm-hmm. But let's not, by the same token, be exclusive in our definition of personhood so that we can end up excluding members of our own species.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so to my mind, I don't know that... So I think the way most pro-choice people that I've come into contact with actually through this podcast... don't look at it as, I remember specifically, Piliucci when I had him on, he phrased it as, he sees the right of the mother as trumping the right of the child. Because, when you say, for example, you know, the fetus or whatever it is, which depending on which point has a right to life, the hypothetical thought experiments that people bring up, are like, well, do you have an obligation to let someone take from you, let this other life take from you, let et cetera? Do you have an obligation to do these things to keep this thing alive? Because the examples that they can bring up sort of throw that into doubt for me. So, like, one example I saw was, like, let's say that I think they brought up some celebrity at the time. I can't remember. I think it was we'll just pick one. But let's say Burt Reynolds. does Burt Reynolds say it's in his power? He can, if he flies to Las Vegas right now, he can say he's still alive, right? Yeah. he can save this life, for some reason. I forget what the exact reason for the thought experiment was, but anyway, and it's like, does he have an obligation to do that? It's in his power. No one else can do it, but he can't. Well, it's like he has his own life to live. And while it would be nice, you know, like it would be good for him to do that, it's hard to say that he has to do that, that he has to give up whatever his life plans are at any time because he can provide for this life. And they phrase it, I've seen thought experiments that phrase it more in those terms where the mother doesn't have the obligation to, you know, be... put herself through. I mean, motherhood is a difficult thing, and to put herself through all that to keep the being alive, she doesn't have that obligation. I'm sure you've seen these arguments as well. I mean, the violinist one is right. Phrased similarly. So, yeah. What is your response to that sort of reasoning?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good argument, and I think there's a lot of merit to that argument because, you know, certainly we've all got bodily autonomy and we've all got value the freedom and independence that we have. And it comes down, for me, the question of whether or not parents have an obligation to their offspring. Because in the case of Burt Reynolds, for instance, he might have the ability to save a life, but is he morally obligated to that life? Because I think you can make the case that a mother is morally obligated to her offspring. And in a case of a mother who had, say, a newborn, for instance, nobody would say, well, you know, she's not obligated to take care of that child. She can just go and live her life if she wants to and go off to, you know, Bermuda and enjoy a nice vacation with her friends while leaving the baby in the basement till later. Parents have an obligation to take care of, you know, at least to the base level of feeding and sheltering their children. So if the preborn are human beings, biological human beings like her born offspring, then should she not have the same obligation to provide basic care for that child as well, including food and shelter?
Yeah, no, that's a good way of phrasing it because there is definitely, I mean, I don't think that even the staunchest pro-choice person would they say that mothers have the right to just leave their kid, abandon their kids? I don't know. I doubt it. Yep. That'd be a pretty tough argument to make. I do. And that there was some level that I actually did say that sort of thing to Pigliucci. We didn't have time to totally get into it, but I do think there is a certain amount of responsibility that you take, but I think that that could be different in the case of, and I think we need to, it's very important to talk about these cases in the case of rape, in the case of incest, in the case, those sort of things. Does your view change? It sounds like the logic of your view can't change. It sounds like, based on how you've outlined it, you know, it's a human, it's a member of the species, it gets rights. Even in the most horrible case of rape, it sounds like your view ought to be that they have an obligation to have the child. I don't want to put words on your mouth, but that's where the logic leads.
Sure. Just before I go into that, I'd like to clarify also that when it comes down to a case of, for instance, like the violinist or Burt Reynolds, and whether a child can be abandoned by their parents, abortion doesn't merely abandon the child. Abortion is an act of killing that child, of actively dismembering, decapitating this child. So that's an element that also comes into it, is that we're not just saying, well, too bad, you can fend for yourself. This child has no ability to fend for themselves. And that becomes because they're younger, because they, at that age and stage of development, a human child cannot survive in any other way. And if a mother is going to feed and shelter her child as she would feed and shelter a born child, well, the way that you feed and shelter a pre-born child is through the continuation of pregnancy. That's the way our species operates. You can't feed and shelter a child otherwise.
But it's almost like technology has, you know, allowed us to abandon that plan. You know, it's like before technology was available, I think, yeah, that makes sense. But it's, I guess they would see it as that's the equivalent of deciding no longer to support your child. And it's only something that's available recently.
Right. And I think, you know, a parent doesn't have the obligation to continue to support their child. And that actually goes into the whole issue with rape. Nobody is obligated to raise a child, but we are obligated to not kill a child. And if that's what we're talking about, a human being, a developing human being, then the parent doesn't have the option of just saying, well, I don't want to continue the care, I'm just going to terminate this child. A parent has to at least wait for however long it takes to pass on that care to someone else. So if a parent, for instance, is stuck in, you know, a cabin in the woods somewhere and snowed in, they can't just arbitrarily decide, well, you know, this kid's pissing me off, I don't want to have this care, I just, you know, I cannot take care of this, I can't even handle this. They would have to at least wait until someone else could come and take over the responsibilities. And that's the same case when it comes to pregnancy, is that, you know, yes, unfortunately with technology, you know, we can do a lot to prevent a pregnancy, but once pregnancy has begun, the only way to continue that care is to wait until that care can be passed on to someone else at birth.
So can I ask then, in the case of rape or incest, does this still hold?
Okay. In the case of rape, like that is a hard case emotionally. And it's really, I have a hard time with pro-lifers who are like, oh, just whatever, who cares, just have a baby, and, you know, looking at it very flippantly, because this is tough. This is really, really hard emotionally. There is a woman who has been victimized and has been, if she gets pregnant from this, she's been essentially forced into care against her will and against her consent. And that is unfair, and that is really, really hard. And I think we're not hard enough on rapists. I think we don't do enough to discourage rape. There's the whole rape culture, slut shaming. There's a lot that we should be doing. And I think that rapists should have to do hard time. They should have to be severely punished. Now, my question is, should that punishment also be extended to the rapist's child? Because the rapist's child is a bystander in the rape. The child itself is not the criminal, it's not the rapist. It's someone who was forced upon the woman, but was not himself the forcer. And when it comes to rape, the question comes down again, is this a human being? Because if it is a human being, then we don't give the death penalty to human beings for their parents' crime.
Well, I really appreciate the I think that this is likely going to piss off a lot of people. But I at least appreciate the integrity, because I actually think that if you're following your logic, and if you believe that from the moment of conception, it's a human, I don't think it matters how the human came to be. Now, that's accepting your logic. I don't accept that. I think that we need to come up with some criteria that determines, when a fetus has rights. You've laid out your position, and I don't personally accept that. I think that even though you make the argument that, it doesn't need to have consciousness, some people don't have consciousness, I think there's on the whole, a package of, qualifications we can use to determine when a fetus has rights. And I think it's a bit more than just being a member of our species. But I will say, I was actually talking about this a little while ago. With somebody else who was, flipping out over, people do flip out when these conservatives in our country over here, when these conservatives do say, like, even in a case of rape, the mother has to have the child and all that. Liberals hate that, go nuts over it, understandably so, because it's really difficult. But I thought at the time, this was pretty recently, I think there was some quote I heard, and I was talking to my friend about it. I was thinking, like, well, I mean, if your point of view is that the fetus is a human, I think that's what you'd have to say. I mean, you'd have to say that you can't just kill a human because of the circumstances that it was created in. And so I think that it's a weird, kind of interesting distinction, but I think it matters, because I think that a lot of times people try to assign motivations, like, oh, this evil man trying to, tell me I have to have a kid when I've been raped. And it's sort of that, but not really. I mean, it's not always, clearly in your case too. I mean, that's not your motivation. You just think that, the result of that rape is a human, and you can't punish the human for the parent's crime. So I do respect that takes guts, I think, to express that point of view. Yeah. It must be difficult.
It is difficult. And to be fair, I don't represent all pro-lifers, and okay. I know for a fact that there are some pro-lifers who would disagree with me on the issue of rape. And so I would say to somebody who is, looking into the arguments and considering, can I be pro-life or not, don't let this be the one thing that keeps you in the pro-choice all the way camp, because we are only talking about 1% of cases, which, granted, is still a large number when it comes down just to it statistically. But majority of cases of abortion are for socioeconomical reasons. And that's, you can get that from the Alan Guttmacher Institute, Planned Parenthood's research arm.
Okay, so you would say that, do you have an estimate of sort of pro-life humanists, like what percentage agree with you, just anecdotally, in the case of rape? Do you have any idea?
I'd say the vast majority do. I don't have an exact number.
No, of course not. Yeah, I'm just wondering what your feeling is, because it's a group you're involved in that I'm not, so I have no idea. So you'd say majority.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That is interesting. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Another really interesting thought experiment for anybody who's struggling with the whole question of rape is one called the de facto guardian. If you Google that, it'll come up with the case, and I don't know if we have time to go into those arguments.
Go ahead. Go ahead. We have time.
Yeah. The de facto argument, de facto guardian argument, is essentially a case where you are a woman is kidnapped and put into a cabin, and she's told that she has there's a baby that's been put into this cabin with her. She's not related to this baby, and she's given a certain amount of food, and the note on whoever's kidnapped her and left this note in the cabin with her basically says, if this baby is taken care of, at the end of it you'll be let out alive, six weeks from now or whatever. And the question is, even though she has no biological obligation to this child, is she still responsible to keep this child alive. Then if you change the scenario a little bit, you say, well, okay, what if there was no food available, but she was a breastfeeding mother, and then she had to use her own body to keep this stranger alive? Would she still have a moral obligation to keep this child alive? Or would she be justified in just saying, well, you know, no, I don't want to care for this child, and decapitate the child, throw him outside? Oh, and by the way, if you kill this child, you'll be freed immediately. Would you then still be justified in killing this child, or would you have an obligation to keep the child alive? So I think we can see in cases like that, that even if there is no intent to create this being, even if it was completely forced upon you, the very fact that it's a dependent human life means that we have an obligation to provide basic care.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't think I agree with that, but I see the logic of the experiment. So my thoughts when I hear that is, no, she doesn't have an obligation to keep the baby alive. I mean, why does she, like, why? Let me ask you this. What if it was an adult in the another adult who just for some reason didn't have the skill or something necessary to keep his or herself alive in this particular situation? I mean, would she still have an obligation? Is it just because it's a child, or is it just any human who can't care for itself?
No, I think we have an instinct that is correct, that children, by virtue of their dependence, demand a certain amount of care. I mean, we see this all the time. You
but
know,
what if you're an adult with dependence?
Sure. You know, if you're talking about a disabled adult, then by all means.
So
I don't
if someone's
think that...
kidnapped and put into this situation, just to go with the thought experiment, they are required, if it's a some sort of adult who has whatever reason they're dependent, I guess would be the best word for it. They have an obligation to take care of that person?
At very least, we have an obligation to not decapitate and dismember the person, yes.
Well, now, that's a good point. I mean, I do see that point. But I don't know that I'd say you have an obligation to take care of the person. But I think that's something I haven't thought about. And I think that's an interesting point that you brought up earlier and again now. It's like, even though I would say that I don't think the person, if they're put, the mother, if they're put in that situation, and in the thought experiment, doesn't need to be a mother. I mean, it could be me. I mean, if I'm put into the cabin with a baby, I would likely take care of the baby, but I don't think I have an obligation. And for example, if I had some reason, like say I had other people dependent on me out there in the world, or I had other obligations, I don't believe that it's right to be held hostage because there is a dependent life that is just put, you know, I'm put in the same room with. So but I think that you bring up a very interesting and compelling point when you say you can't just kill that thing. I mean, you can't, I also don't think you could, you know, just murder it. So I think that's the interesting question for me now in thinking about it, and something that's a little challenging that I think I'm gonna have to think about. Because I guess there is something different in, I mean, I suppose it's sort of just a result of the biology of it. I mean, because if it were the truth that babies, that you could just ignore them and they'd go away, they'd, you know, die on their own, it would be, in my mind, under the thought experiment that we, you know, talked about, it would be the equivalent of just not taking care of it. But because it's in your body, it requires being essentially killed by a doctor in order to no longer care for it. So in some ways, I still view that as okay, because it's essentially medically doing something that's going to happen anyway if the mother were able to just abandon it, but she can't because of biology.
Right. And again, that goes back to the point that we made earlier. Why should she be able to abandon this child? If the preborn are biologically members of our human species, then if she has a moral obligation to her born children to feed and provide basic sustenance and care for them, why should she not have that same obligation to her preborn offspring?
I don't think the qualification or the criteria of just being a member of our species, I don't think that grants personhood to me. And I think that I'm curious if that has implications for the other end of life too. I mean, do you think we're required to keep humans alive as long as possible, even when they're vegetables? I mean, that would be the same logic, wouldn't it? I mean, it's a member of our species.
Yes, but there's a difference between no more and not yet. If there's a function, for instance, you know, brain capacity is gone and the person is in a vegetative state from which they're never going to emerge, that's a totally different thing than someone who doesn't have the function to think yet because they're too young.
Interesting. I guess I don't look at it that way. And I think that's a good argument. But I think for me, rather than looking at potential or whatever, when a fetus is at a certain point, I don't think it qualifies as a person. But I see your logic there. So that's interesting.
Can I just ask, like, what your reasons are and what you think would qualify for granting personhood?
I'm not a scientist, so I don't have a precise view, and it's certainly something that I'd research more before I made any huge, like, decision. I haven't had, you know, it hasn't come up for me other than, you know, in general having a point of view about it. But I would say that some level of feeling pain, of some level of a consciousness, awareness, some level of that, because when you're talking about cells, I mean, we kill cells every day. I mean, cells are technically some sort of cells in our skin are technically part of our species in some way. I mean, they're human cells, but they're not, you know, they're not conscious. They're not aware. They're not anything. And when a fetus is not conscious, not aware, not any of these things, just because it could hypothetically become that, I think what some people would say is our cells, any cell could hypothetically become that in the lab now. I mean, we could grow, stem cells, we could engineer this so that certain cells could become, you know, it's not
embryos.
Legal, but yeah, they could become embryos. So the potential for being a human doesn't quite do it. So for me, it has to be some criteria, which, you know, admittedly, I don't have like some firm handle on. But I do think that it's not a conception. I don't believe, you know, I don't believe in that.
Okay. Well, if I could just answer some of those.
Sure.
You mentioned cells. Now, that's really interesting to me because, you know, you talk about skin cells and, you know, blood cells, sperm and ovum. They each have human DNA. And do they each individually have the capacity, for instance, skin cells to be cloned to become embryos? Yeah, you could say that. You know, it's very possible to clone. And yet, that's not what I'm talking about when I say that a human life begins at fertilization.
Hmm.
Because an embryo, a zygote, the when sperm and ovum have merged together, is different from a sperm or an ovum. Because you look at what a sperm is, what an ovum is, and they each have their own function. They each have their own, their parts belonging to another human being. Now, when they come together, there is a new entity that comes into existence. There's a new whole with a completely different function, a function to develop its body throughout the course of human development, according to the pattern of human development that is in it. So that's a totally different thing than a skin cell, which has genetic possibilities, but not until you create an embryo do you have an entity with the inherent capacity to grow and develop itself through all stages of human development.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. So it's almost like when you talk about doing it, you know, making any sort of cell into a life via science, if that were possible. Mm-hmm. So you're saying once... hypothetically say we did that, once we did make it into something that was, you know, had that trajectory toward being a person, I guess, then it would have those rights. But also, before then, you know, that's why cells don't have rights. That's why, you know, any sort of sloughing of human cells doesn't, a cluster of cells doesn't have rights because it's not on that trajectory, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right, right. Because only a human, a living thing, has the capacity to develop itself to a mature version of that living thing. You know, because living things aren't like, you know, a table, for instance. You know, when is a table complete? Well, a table has to have the base, it has to have four legs. And if you take any part away from that table, you don't have a table. You know, if you cut off the legs, you just got a slab of wood. Living things aren't like that. Living things develop. So, you know, it's not like I'm not saying that an embryo or a zygote is exactly the same as an adult. You know, obviously there's a huge developmental difference, but living things are developing according to the pattern of what they already are.
Hmm. So, okay, so there's two, and I think I should have, I maybe should have talked about this earlier, but I think there are two different ways that people tend to be pro-choice. And sometimes it's a combination, but we've sort of addressed both of them, but I just want to lay them out there to make sure. So some of my arguments I've talked about have been that the fetus isn't a human, or it isn't something that gets human rights. And that's one angle people take. And then the other angle, and I think this is more common in philosophy, is that, literally if the fetus were just a grown human, just like, instead of just hypothetically, a grown human, living, thinking human, the mother still would not have an obligation to bring it to term and take care of it and all that. And so there's sort of two different ways that people go about it. I blended those a little bit, and I should have kept those more distinct, because I think they are very different. So I think the violinist, for example, that thought experiment deals more with rights trumping rights versus what I was saying earlier about the fetus not being, you know, a person yet. That deals more with, well, if it's a person, then I guess I'd agree that you can't abort it. But when it's, you know, at some imaginary line that's kind of hard to define, once it's a person versus not, you know, before that you can abort and after that you can't. So those are sort of two different things. I just wanted to be kind of neat and clean about it. So,
right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when it comes to personhood, we have to be careful. Like, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about the definitions of human being. We don't want to equate the two and get the two confused, because person is a legal term. And there have been throughout history many biological members of our species who have been denied legal personhood. So those are two very distinct things. Now, again, I do believe that all biological members of our species should have personhood. In fact, this is probably the history lesson that seems to be taking our species the longest.
Well, unless they're brain dead, right? I mean, that seems right. Like you don't think it should be a person then.
But then they're no longer a person.
Well, how would they not be a person?
There is a difference. Well, there's a difference between, like I said, there's a difference between no more and not yet. For instance, you've got bananas that are rotten and flies all over them. You've got bananas that are totally green. You're not going to throw out the green bananas because they still have that. They're still developing. They're still getting to that point when they're going to be mature and able to be your food. You're going to throw out the rotten ones because those are no more.
But you are introducing something in addition to just being a member of our species.
Well, to be a member of the species is to be a living entity belonging to the species. The dead are not living entities. Someone who is in...
Well, but okay, someone's in a vegetative state and they could live in that state for, you know, throughout their lives. They just don't have the cognitive abilities anymore. They don't have the, you know, they still are a living organism. And they're technically a member of our species.
Yeah, I can understand where you're going with that, and I think the distinction is that they lack the capacity to function as a human being, and they will never have that capacity to function as a whole human being.
And then someone else, you know, someone would say, "Well, the fetus lacks the capacity to function as
but
a human being."
But they will have. That's the thing.
But they don't. I think the fact that they don't is where maybe the main disagreement comes on, because that's viewed as important. The fact that they will someday have this function, whereas I think I can see the argument that since they don't have it, you're not killing anything by killing them.
Okay, well, let me just ask you this then. When it comes to an amoeba can't think, right? And neither can an embryo. The question is, though, why can't the amoeba think?
Uh-huh. I'm not going to answer that. That's too... I understand. Okay, go on.
So why can't the amoeba think versus why can't the embryo think? Now, the amoeba can't think because it's not in its nature. It's not something that it can do. The embryo can't think because it's too young. It hasn't had the time to develop that skill yet. And that boils down to ageism, if you're going to say that because they haven't yet had the chance to develop that skill, we're not going to include them in the capacity for rights, and we're going to disqualify them from any future capacity for rights.
Okay, so this is, and I see your argument. I think it's well done. I think it's well made. So I'll have to think more about that. And I am very curious what the listeners are going to think. Maybe I'm missing some counter argument, but please let me know, listeners, because I think that's an interesting argument. It's honestly, that's something I've thought about a long time ago, because what I would say too is if you come into a room and someone's under, you know, completely passed out medically under anesthesia, they are still a person, and you'd have to define why. I mean, they aren't currently functioning. Like, there's no brain activity, or there's not a lot of, you know, not the normal amount of brain activity. There's probably something, but but they're not. When you go under like that, you don't dream. Like, you're just out. So, but there's still a reason why they're a person. I wonder if maybe just thinking about it now, if maybe they would say the difference is that they underwent this procedure, or they, you know, there's an agreement, they have a will, they had a will before it that can still, you know, exist during it or something. Whereas a child is, they've never been old enough to have a will, like a, you know, any sort. So I don't know. I'm curious what listeners are going to say, how I should have, what arguments I should have brought up. But I think it's a tough argument, so I'm sort of gonna have to think about it more, I think.
Yeah, if I can just add something to that, the fact that you've had it before, I just wonder, like, this seems to be very subjective to me, that you could say, well, you know, well, they've had this amount of consciousness. Well, how much consciousness? You know, how long do they have had consciousness in order for us to count them? You know, it just seems very like we're kind of picking and choosing things really arbitrarily. And, you know, you could have, for instance, a case of a child who's born and they're conscious for, 3 minutes, and then they fall into a coma for 9 months. And then you have someone else who is not conscious at all. They're born in a coma and they emerge 9 months later. Well, you basically have to say that at 8 months, one of them is a person because they were conscious for 3 minutes, whereas the other one, because they've never been conscious yet, it would be okay for us to kill them.
Well, but you sort of made that determination when you said that, you know, someone at the end of their life, or maybe not even at the end of whatever, they might be 20 and they get in a car accident. If they don't have brain activity, you made a distinction there because they're not going to gain it back.
Right. That's the difference between a reversible coma and an irreversible coma.
Well, how do you know, though?
Someone who's, you know, that's a fair point. And, you know, maybe we could consider that, you know, perhaps we should be leaving people in vegetative states on respirators and, you know, whatnot.
God, I hope not.
That's not, you know, something that I'm personally would advocate. But I do know that if someone is in a reversible coma and we know for a fact that they're going to come out of it, then just because someone was born and had 3 minutes of consciousness, should we then value them more than the person who was born in a reversible coma and hasn't yet come out of it?
Yeah, I like I said, I'm going to think about these questions. I think they're well posed. And I'm sure I'll have plenty of help from listeners. I always get plenty of comments about whatever I didn't think of at the time. Okay, I'm trying to think if there's more ground to cover.
There's always more ground to cover.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, if you get feedback from listeners, I'd be more than happy to come back and answer the.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah, I'd love that.
So, yeah, you know, this is a big question. It's a big issue. And
yeah, I do think it is. And like we started out with, I really don't think that it's as cut and dry as people make it out to be. So I certainly have respect for both positions. I think there's a lot that goes on, and there's a lot of consideration people make for how sexist it can end up being, because just by an accident of biology, women are saddled with this burden, you know, even in, especially when you're saying they have to carry a child to term in the case of rape. I mean, they didn't agree to it. They didn't, you know, that it was forced on them, you know, sometimes violently, and yet they have to bear this child. I mean, there's a lot that goes on that motivates this. And I think that the hardline stance of the fetus is a human, I think that it's consistent. I will at least say, you know, it's definitely consistent, but I think on the whole, it ends up being kind of morally wrong when we would force a woman to carry a baby to term, because I think there's more harm done in that to the world on the whole than aborting, say, in the, you know, first, whenever they, the earliest they possibly can, 3 weeks or something, whatever it would be. However, probably not quite, I don't know. When can they, what's the earliest abortion that they can recognize that someone is pregnant and abort? I guess it would be like the morning after. No, that's not abortion.
Well, yeah, the morning after pill, that's debatable as to whether it does right, anything. Yeah, yeah. I used to think so, and I'm reconsidering that. So I'm currently, the jury's out on that one. But I know that most abortions happen between the 8th and the 12th week.
Okay, so. Yeah. I figured it took some time in there. It is definitely not something I'm too terribly informed on, as you can tell. But just in terms of, you know, the science of pregnancy and stuff, not something I've studied. But I do know it takes a certain amount of time before they even realize that it's always once you find out you're pregnant, it's like, oh, when did I get pregnant? Not sure. Could have been 2 weeks ago. Could have been 4 weeks ago. But anyway. I think that there's a lot more harm done on the whole. When we would make, especially like incest rape victim, I mean, when we would make force that person to carry the baby to term, I think there's a lot more harm done than aborting it at the earliest possible point. But I think it is consistent.
I would say it depends on how you define harm.
Oh, certainly.
Because, you know, first of all, it has not been proven that an abortion helps a rape victim. I think there's a lot of people who would both think that that would be the case, but there's been a lot of studies done on people who have been raped and gotten pregnant, and some of them who chose rape, some of them who didn't choose rape. And you know,
there's
who didn't choose, some of them who didn't choose.
I don't think
abortion.
Any of them chose rape. I'll just go ahead
you.
And say, yeah.
One particularly good study would be the one by David Riordan called Victims and Victors. He collected a lot of stories of women who had been raped and who had chosen abortion, women who had been raped and chosen pregnancy, and a lot of them found they were able to find meaning, that something good was able to come out of the rape because
key is choosing there. I mean, yeah. When there's a rape victim, I'm going to go ahead and say they can choose whether they want to, you know, no one's going to enforce an abortion, I would hope. I mean, I'm not going to enforce an abortion on anyone. I think choice is the key there. And I think that if you took your point of view, having to tell that victim that they have to keep the child, I really think that's horrible. I can't imagine doing that. So while I think that it's a self-consistent thing, I think it's hard to poke a hole in the argument. I for one could never do that. I mean, I could never tell a rape victim that they had to keep their child.
Yeah. And also the word keep is an interesting word, because you're right. Like, you know, there is a lot of emotional baggage that would be, you know, every time she would see this child, she'd be like, oh my God, that's the face of my rapist. That's why, you know, I'm really happy.
And not
that there
to mention,
is
not to mention that she might have had a life trajectory. You know, she was in the middle. She could have been doing anything. I mean, she could have been in the midst of finishing a graduate degree. Yet now she's forced to. She could have been a high power sort of job, and now she's forced to be sidelined by a pregnancy that she didn't choose. I mean, that can really disrupt someone's life. I could not imagine telling the person that they have an obligation at week 3. To carry out this thing, you know, it just, to me, I couldn't imagine it, but I think we need different criteria for what qualifies as a person, you know, a human person. That would be the main objection, but I don't know. That's tough.
Yeah. I can totally sympathize. That would be very, very difficult and very hard. And I'm not suggesting that this wouldn't be, that we could just be like, oh yeah, sure, whatever. You know, she has to sacrifice her problems or whatever. What I'm suggesting though, is that we need to be killing problems, not people. That we should be ending suffering, not the sufferers. And to suggest that, you know, these problems can just be solved by killing someone, which is what abortion comes down to, I don't think is a really good solution. In fact, Don Markey, who's an atheist, has written a really good paper that I recommend that people look up, and it's called Why Abortion is Immoral. And in that paper, he suggests that what makes killing wrong in general is what is taken away from the person, from the human being, all the years that they would have lived. And for instance, that's one of the reasons why we generally feel much more, you know, upset when a child is killed than when like a, you know, 98-year-old person is killed, because we realize, well, they had a whole lifetime of experiences and things that they would have been able to enjoy, and those were taken away from them. Those are experiences, good food, good friends, orgasms, things that we all have the opportunity to enjoy as human beings, that is robbed and denied them. And that actually goes back to the point that we were making earlier about, you know, what about someone who's in a persistent vegetative state? Technically, they're alive. Yes, that's true. But do they have the opportunity for meaningful experiences anymore? And I would argue that no. Whereas the fetus, even though they're not currently having meaningful experiences, has that opportunity to have meaningful experiences. And barring illness or violence, all human beings, once they've won the lottery of life and have come into existence, have this opportunity to grow up, to go to school. You know, hopefully they have an opportunity for education, but just to experience things that are human experiences. And I think that for those of us who won the lottery of life, to steal someone else's winning lottery ticket away from them is completely unthinkable. And even though we're talking about hard cases, what we need to be thinking is, how can we have solutions that, despite their challenge, despite how challenging it is, that we still do what's right, even when it's hard?
Well, I definitely I respect your integrity with that. I mean, it's a difficult position to hold, like I said earlier. And I I still just I can't imagine having that stance. I can imagine the logic, and I get it, but. I think it's interesting that you said what we're taking away, because taking away a potential for something is interesting. I mean, compared with taking away, you know, the experience that someone has already had. For example, I mean, in the case of a mother, like giving up, if you have to choose between the life of the mother and the infant, I mean, for me, I would always choose. I would choose the life of the mother. I mean, she's had the experiences. She has the people in her life that already find her important and find her valuable and need her. And do, you know, versus the potential for life. You know, that's potential. I mean, yeah, it is something, but it's not. You're not missing anything. You know, nothing's being robbed because there's nothing there yet. It's just potential. And I don't quite see things the same way.
Well, you could say that about an infant, though. An infant that's just been born has not had it.
I agree.
So should we be able to kill infants then?
No, we shouldn't be able to kill it. But I think when you're making a choice between rights, that's when you can use that as a criteria. I would say, though, that if someone just gave me a choice in some horrifying situation, up to a certain age, I would just choose the mother. I mean, if there's some horrible like balance of like one has to die, I mean, I value someone living now. And of course, you know, it changes. Someone who's 98, who's lived a full life, who's likely not going to live much longer, it sort of does change. It's tough. It's not a hard and fast rules kind of thing. But just personally, I mean, I value that current living being more than someone who hasn't lived yet and hasn't formed bonds with people and hasn't, you know, done all that yet.
That's interesting. And it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that's more of an emotional argument than it is a moral one. Because, for instance, I don't know your mother. And, you know, if somebody were, assuming she's still alive, if somebody were to kill your mother, like, I'd be like, you know, that's really sad, and I would feel sad for you. But it wouldn't have the same emotional impact as if somebody were to kill my mother. And that doesn't mean that it would be morally acceptable for someone to kill your mother because I don't have an emotional attachment to her. That's not how we decide human rights.
Yeah, no, that's a good argument. But it's when we're trying to decide between, when there's conflicting human rights, and the, you know, the baby, the fetus, whatever, you know, the correct term is, but they've never had this experience. They've never had these ties. They've never had, you know, people who know them and joke with them and have experiences with them. There, it's not so much an emotional argument as a look at the emotional ties, the fact of the emotional ties. I mean, to me the living mother's rights, when they're put in conflict, is going to trump the fetus because of that. So I like your argument. That's an interesting one. But I do agree that if it was simply you know, determining emotionally. You can't use emotion to determine arguments. I agree with that. But emotions and emotional ties are a factor in that you have to look at. And that's what you were doing when you said, you know, they're taking away the potential for, you know, potential for life. I mean, that is, that's taking that into account. That's taking into account experiences and all that. And that, I think I was arguing along those lines, not along the lines of,
yeah,
you know, what makes me emotionally happier. But maybe I misspoke. So, yeah, I'd really like to thank you for coming on. And I'm really glad that you said you'd like to come on again, because I want to get people's responses, and I'd be very curious to run those by you.
Yeah, that would be wonderful if you know, if people want to send emails, or you know, whether they want to come in on your show and ask questions directly, I'd be more than happy to answer those questions.
Awesome. So where would you like to direct people? I know you're pro-life humanists, but feel free to plug anything you'd like, and where can people find you?
Sure. And my website is prolifehumanists.org. That's all one word, prolifehumanists, plural, .org. We're also on Facebook, so you can find us at Pro-Life Humanist on Facebook. And at Twitter, we're Pro-Life Humanist, plural, yeah. Or singular, because they just the wouldn't limit, give me yeah. enough darn letters.
Yeah, my Twitter is an abomination, pretty much, because it's like atheistically speaking was far too long.
Yeah.
But anyway. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I really loved having you, and I appreciate your coming on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.